Welcome to the Dialogues Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Asian American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary. This podcast features the voices of Asian American scholars, ministry leaders, and activists in an ongoing dialogue about theology and ministry. We provide Asian American ministry leaders with a forum for dialogue, support, and critical reflection on ministry by Asian Americans, especially in Asian American ecclesial contexts.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. David Chow. I direct the Center for Asian American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary. It's my joy to host tonight's Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry event. The Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry provides Asian American ministry leaders with a forum for dialogue, support, and critical reflection on ministry by Asian Americans, especially in Asian American ecclesial contexts. Tonight's topic is discipleship in diaspora, and it's my privilege, and I'm really excited to introduce our two speakers. First, we have Reverend Sabrina Chan, who is the National Director of Asian American Ministries for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and a daughter of immigrants from Hong Kong. She is an author of Learning Our Names, and we have several copies available here. Asian American Christians on Identity, Relationships, and Vocation. Sabrina has led in church and campus ministries for 25 years. Prior to her national role, she led ministry teams in Texas and the San Francisco Bay Area. Welcome, come on in. And has also been a computer network engineer. Her ministry work is to disciple, develop, and empower distinctly Asian American Christian leaders, women and men across the diversity of Asian America. Sabrina earned her Master of Arts in Theology from Fuller Seminary and her Bachelor of Science in Engineering from Rice University. E. David De Leon resides in New York City with his two sons and wife. Originally from the San Francisco Bay Area, he is a child of Filipino immigrants. David completed his MDiv at Yale Divinity School in 2021 and is currently pursuing a PhD in systematic theology at Fordham University. Welcome, come on in, where he is also an undergraduate instructor. His research examines Christian doctrines of providence and eschatology as deployed in colonial, imperial, and civilizing projects with a particular eye towards histories of Spanish and American colonialism in the Philippines and the lives of diasporic Filipinos. He serves as a content strategist for Christians for Social Action and produces the podcast 20 Minute Takes. He thinks, writes, and teaches along the lines of Asian American and Filipino American theology. Let's welcome both Sabrina and David. Come on up, David. The floor is yours.
Thank you again for having us, Dr. Chow, and for those of you spending your evening with us here, and those of you online, thank you so much for joining us. So as mentioned, I grew up in the great state of California in the city of Vallejo, just 45 minutes northeast of San Francisco. And it was an interesting place to be raised. It was part ethno-Berb, part blue-collar town. And in the second half of the 20th century, the Mare Island Naval Base, the largest employer in town, brought droves of Filipino families to settle in the city, families whose presence would outlast the naval base itself. My family, though not a military family, heard about the more affordable housing at the top of the Bay Area, where many Filipinos began to concentrate around the 70s. And so this is the space that oriented me to the world around me. A significant amount of my own formation took place in my Filipino-American Assemblies of God immigrant church. Whether it was at church or the Catholic school that I attended, Filipinos were everywhere. As a child, I had no idea that the rest of the world did not look like Vallejo, California. I did not realize how unique an experience it was to have multiple Filipino grocery stores to choose from or to hear your parents speak Tagalog with your car mechanic. It was a beautiful and complicated place to grow up. Though my wife and I spent nearly the first decade of our marriage in California, and though both of my children were both born back in the Bay, we've been living in the Northeast now for 5 years, away from the cousins and aunties and uncles and grandparents and the abundance, again, of Filipino supermarkets. That's not to say that there aren't any Filipinos out here. It's just different. It's taken this cross-coastal displacement for me to reflect on my own formation as a Filipino-American Christian from California. Seeing my kids grow up in such a drastically different environment from the one that I grew up in, it's got me paying attention to how they are being formed as Filipino-American Christians in New York City, away from the cousins and the aunties and uncles, from the grocery stores and immigrant churches of my youth. And so I ask myself, how are their struggles like mine? How are their questions different from the ones that I ask? How do they feel about their skin, their nose, their world that reads them as some sort of Asian? And how does God help them to make sense of it all or not? So this evening, as Sabrina and I engage around this notion of discipleship in diaspora, my hope is to explore, not necessarily with any definitive answers, the challenges that exist for spiritual formation and the discipleship of Asian American Christians, particularly young adults. I want to draw attention especially to the challenges that arise from our diasporic experience. And so what I'll be talking tonight are the allure of roots and the idea of return, the orientation of our identities wrapped up in some sort of cultural nationalism, we could call it that. And finally, the way that both of these challenges shape our political imagination as Christians. In the chapters that I wrote for our book, Learning Our Names, I attempted to press our readers to think more concretely about what we mean when we use terms like identity and culture. And Dr. Kiju Choi's work was incredibly helpful for us in sort of thinking through this. How we might rearticulate these often used, often confusing terms for ordinary Asian American Christian. And so we sought to frame identity as something like the stories and histories that we lay claim to that have shaped us. And this way of speaking of identity was an attempt to move away from essentialist and flat, often abstracted notions of identity that had come to fill the Christian discourse on ethnic identity development in the ministry context that I was in. And so as identity is understood as stories and histories, we articulated culture as how identity, meaning the way of being in the world, was shaped by the stories and history, how culture is actually the living out of these stories and histories in a particular time and place. We spoke of culture this way to draw the circle wider for how people thought about their own ethnic backgrounds, to highlight the diversity of experiences of people who may even share the same background. As my own experience and that of my sons can show us, being Filipino American in Northern California is very different from being Filipino American in New York City. And yet my sons and I both have an equal claim to the story of our people. By bringing notions of culture and identity down to earth, our hope was to ground these terms in history and tangible experience. And by doing this, laying bare all that has been at stake in the formation of Asian American identity from a political and a social standpoint. Put another way, the ways that we had attempted to disciple Asian American Christians up until that point emphasized notions of self-discovery, self-love, self-understanding. And while all those emphases were important to pull those conversations out of the real histories of immigration or racialization or xenophobia or labor or white supremacy or anti-blackness or settler colonialism, would have and did in many cases compromise the integrity of the formation we had sought to effect in those that we led. Without more critical reflections on culture and identity, the Asian American Christians we helped to disciple were simply not ready to engage meaningfully in movements for racial justice or have their consciousness and faith politicized in necessary ways. The question then becomes, what stories and histories do we actually tell? And to what end, when we journey with young Asian American Christians in their formation? If we understand the journey of spiritual growth to be one that orients a life around the story told and received in faith about the truth of who Jesus is, then a life lived in the direction of Jesus is one that's wrapped up in his story. To transpose the notion of identity I offered earlier, it's accepting an invitation into the story of Jesus and allowing those stories to guide and form and shape us. This is what happens when the word of God breaks through the written scriptures. This is what happens when we receive wisdom and revelation through our tradition or through our elders or spiritual ates and kuyas, our spiritual siblings. When thinking through our ethnic identities, then we have to ask ourselves what stories and histories shape how we understand ourselves and how we interact with the world as embodied people. Asking this question isn't meant to separate this dimension of identity from that of our spiritual formation, but we ask it knowing that our ethnicities and cultures are wrapped up in Jesus's own enfleshed story. In his Acts commentary, theologian Willie Jennings, when reflecting on Jewish diaspora, says, "The condition of diaspora is often bound up with life under empire." And, or in our terms, the story of scattering brought about by displacement or immigration or other forces inside and outside our family's control is always contending with the domineering story of empire. In our context as Asian American Christians, it's the allure of the impossible and ultimately destructive telos of whiteness by way of assimilation and forgetfulness that this story seeks to grab hold of our individual and collective stories of self-understanding and agency. For Asian Americans during the pandemic, and for many Asian American Christians who became newly conscious of the hollowness of whiteness because of the rise of anti-Asian racism, or at least their awareness of it, or for those who felt the impotence of their supposedly multi-ethnic churches to speak about anti-Black violence and racism that we experienced before, during, and after season one of the pandemic, or even Asian American Christians who long ago had developed consciousness toward the racial reality of America, many had begun to ask, if not whiteness, then what? If not empire, then what? What of my stories will I now offer to Jesus, wrapping my story in his? And so people went looking. And one of the tragedies of this holy realization is that many of our churches were not prepared to deal with the fleshiness and messiness of these questions. And so people, many people, including Asian Americans, left and looked for more compelling stories elsewhere. But even those of us who've remained continue to deal with the question, what stories of mine do I now offer to Jesus? And what orients those stories? This search for stories has led to fruitful and beautiful things. It's the question that I began to ask myself as a young college student, having just discovered how intertwined my own self-hatred was with my self-perception as a Filipino-American man. And so I, like many of the people who have asked this same question, have looked to the past to get a sense of the present. For my journey, I turned to the work of Filipino scholars who articulated Filipino cultural values, things like kapwa, meaning shared identity, or pakikiisa, meaning like oneness or solidarity, or utang na loob, meaning inner debt, reciprocity, to begin to rebuild the grammar embedded in my own story and storytelling. I began to delve into the history of the archipelago now known as the Philippines, familiarizing myself with the contours of the colonial history, Magellan, Spain, Jose Rizal, 1898, the United States, Douglas MacArthur, benevolent assimilation. All concepts and words that would help me articulate a story that I was learning how to tell anew. The major questions that dominated my own exploration of story and history was, who am I? Or questions like, who would I have been if the Philippines had not been colonized? Or who would I be if my parents had not immigrated? And while these are perfectly fine questions to ask, they are nearly impossible to answer. When I spoke earlier of our attempt to re-articulate how identity is talked about, the hope is that laying claim to the stories honors the question, who am I? But it does not frame it as the ultimate question. To ask who am I as the central and ultimate question of the stories in histories we recover is to fall into what post-colonial theorist Gayatri Spivak calls the nostalgia for lost origins. Who was I before the horrors of colonialism were thrust upon my people? Who was I before the pressures of assimilation in the United States came upon my family? Beyond, again, being unanswerable, Spivak reads the nostalgia for lost origins as dulling our political sensibilities and inhibiting our own organizing. The problem that I've observed with how Asian American Christians were formed and in many ways are still being formed is the fixation and allure of the nostalgia for lost origins. It's as though we're acting like if we knew the truth of who we are or were, we would engage with our current situations and circumstances differently. Even the best of our attempts at decolonial praxis can fall unwittingly for the allure of nostalgia for lost origins.
decoloniality, right? We can define that a number of ways, but understanding it as our attempts to confront the afterlives of formal colonialism by unlinking Eurocentric ways of knowing, Western ways of knowing and being, can lead to a fixation on salvation and wholeness and healing by being firmly rooted in the past as though the possibility of return were a viable option. In my context as a Filipino American, this is not meant to discount the ways in which the rediscovery of things like Filipino indigenous practices or wisdom can be a beautiful or enriching thing, or that a reconnection to the homeland is not useful or edifying. What I'm saying, though, is that any attempts to search for story and history cannot foist upon the past the full weight of meaning-making and orientation, as they are insufficient to deal with the consequences of all that has transpired history. This is a challenge given the contours of Filipino-American identity that have tended to be shaped by ideas of the pre-colonial or the indigenous and the promises of return and retrieval. To dive a little bit more into my context, I invite you all to join me. And some of the research around Filipino-American-ness, Filipino-American scholar Dylan Rodriguez helps us to further extend what I mean by the nostalgia for origins, dulling political consciousness, in what he sees as the problem of Filipino-Americanism, reflecting on the way that a common sense notion of Filipino-American-ness, what we might understand even as a sort of cultural nationalism, has been propagated in popular and academic discourse. He argues that Filipino-American identity that's been constructed is oriented around the desires for two things: civil recognition and cultural valorization. These might be crudely understood as legible political and cultural influence, as well as wide forms of popular representation. So influence and representation. Rodriguez reads the site of the formation for these desires to be cultural groups on university campuses, right, that sort of help develop and reproduce the grammar of Filipino-Americanness. Civic participation groups, to which I'd add even popular cultural education via social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram. And the problem that Rodriguez sees is that the dual orientations of civil recognition and cultural valorization, and there's some applicability here to think about Asian America more broadly, deprive Filipino Americans of any meaningful political or social critique of the United States. The empire, the story into which Filipino Americans have tended to seek acceptance. When the nostalgia for lost origins and its related artifacts have been used to fortify versions of identity such as this, we must remain suspicious when our prophetic edge has been dulled. In my experience, far too often our calls towards spiritual ethnic identity development have tended toward the desires of civil recognition and cultural valorization, or have uncritically used the same logics and raw materials to construct what a healthy sense of self might look like. Any attempts that cannot account for the situatedness as Filipino Americans or as Asian Americans in the shadow of empire risk the possibility of glutting ourselves with more knowledge of the past while denying ourselves a prophetic word for the present. The reality is that there is no going back to the time before colonialism or the time before immigration. There is no turning the clock back on modernity and its colonial and racial underpinnings. The healing and salvation we seek as we sift through the shards of our stories cuts through time and space. It's integrative, it acknowledges the trauma, and has an eschatological shape to it. It awaits, not with passivity, the fulfillment and wholeness that is promised in the family of God and the resurrection power of Jesus. Our frameworks for formation and discipleship in diaspora cannot stop at the allure of nostalgia for origins. Theologian Ann Jo, extending and reflecting on Spivak's insights, gives us a helpful framework for a better way to engage with our history and stories. Beyond searching for merely roots, our explorations of story and history must also be attentive to routes or roots, depending on how you pronounce it, R-O-U-T-E-S. To understand the movement and pathways that we and those who've gone before us have taken, either towards solidarity or liberation or greater abundance of life. And this attentiveness to roots and routes, This honors the sacrifices of our elders who sought survival, the trauma we've endured. It also dares to remember our Asian American ancestors and those who forged pathways of resistance in troubling times, much like we find ourselves in today. And so, in addition to asking what our roots are, we must ask ourselves in this moment, what routes have our ancestors taken? What routes might be available to us right now? An attentiveness to not only roots, but routes presses our formation as Asian American Christians, not simply to be polite citizens with polite politics that support the status quo, but enables us to remember modes of resistance to confront injustice and oppression within our communities and beyond. These were the routes taken at the beginning of the Asian American story, around the beginning of Asian American identity that even sort of emerged in the 1960s and 1970s. Forming our sensibilities of identity and culture cannot happen devoid of history or stories and politics. As we give our stories over to Jesus, who was oppressed and suffered under the rule of empire, whose prophetic witness testifies to the overcoming of death and evil by life, we are pressed to do the same with the routes we consider now. The routes that lay before us now press us to remember our own roots and routes of Asian American resistance, anti-militarism, anti-colonialism, the precarity of existence as part of a settler colonial project. And so our discipleship in diaspora, our spiritual formation, must take seriously the politicization of our own communities. Will we take routes of greater solidarity or greater self-protection? As we collectively witness the ongoing apartheid and occupation and unfolding of genocide in Gaza, even right now, and as I watch Asian Americans rally around calls for ceasefire, we remember as Asian American Christians that we find echoes of our stories and histories, and even the histories that are unfolding in our Palestinian siblings right now. Educator, activist, and author Bianca Mabute-Lewi wrote in a recent Substack post, "Asian American solidarity with Palestine demands us to reckon with our own often painful relationships to U.S. empire, as well as our own status as settlers and benefactors of stolen indigenous land," end quote. Telling the truth of our own stories presses us to tell the truth about the stories that are unfolding before us today. As we offer our stories to Jesus, would we as Asian American Christians tell and live stories that are true and just and good? Our hope as we consider our own formation and the formation of those we lead and shape is that we would live into ways that provide for our descendants routes of faithfulness for them to consider and live into.
Thanks, David. That was great.
I thought I'd share a photo of our author team, since you're only getting to see two of us today. David, La, myself, and Linston worked together on this book. And just earlier, somebody asked us, when was the last time you saw David in person? It's been more than 2 years, though we've gotten to talk often. Pandemic season 1, 2, 3, whatever. It's been weird. Yeah, a few caveats to start. I think that's the next slide. I am not an academic, so slightly intimidated to be presenting at the dialogues. But I know enough to know that academics give a lot of caveats, so I start with caveats. I'm a leader and pastor of Asian American Christian Campus Ministers. That's what I've gotten to do in this national role for the last 6 or 7 years. But yeah, spent a lot of time working with Asian American students and campus ministers. And then I think the other caveat would be to say, you know, it's tempting to think that we're always coming up with something new, or we think it's new because it's new to us. But I wanted to say also that I know that I stand on the shoulders of so many who've come before, whether personal mentors or organizational or, you know, in books, etc. So the caveat is, if I start to sound like I'm a little full of myself and saying stuff that like is so brand new, I actually know that probably it isn't that brand new. But I was trying to think about, like, what can I offer to this space, right, to this audience, some students, pastors, practitioners. I think where I ended up was thinking about where David brought us in thinking about the place of no return, right, and the ways that living here in the United States and engaging our Asian American identities brings us to. I was like, oh, I think what I can offer is some perspective on how that can play out. How do we do this? Not saying I have answers, but I have some you know, experiences, both, I'll call it later, pathways and pitfalls, some thoughts. But a little bit more about myself. I, like David, have lived in different spots in the country. So I grew up in the South, where in contrast to David's experience growing up, I never heard anybody speaking Cantonese unless we were at like the Cantonese Bible study or something like that. Actually, the first time when I moved to the Bay Area and I was in a Target and I heard somebody speak Cantonese, I thought it was my aunt. Like, who lives in Hong Kong and would never be in Target in Mountain View? But I was like, wait, what? It was very confusing. I grew up in the South, went to Texas, did campus ministry there, moved to the Bay Area, which was a much different experience. And, you know, in the last 5 years, I've moved back to the South with our family. Like David, I'm a parent, and I have been thinking a lot about where my kids are at, how much Asian America has changed in general, but also how much has stayed the same, particularly in the place that we now live. More on that later. Thinking about future generations has been informing my thinking a lot lately. One of the framing pieces as we wrote was around discernment. So the idea that every people group throughout the centuries has had to discern, what does it mean to follow Jesus in this place, in this time, in this culture, or in these cultures? And for Asian Americans, you know, in the book, we talk some about engaging Asian American history and identity on the next slide. Which has so much to do with history, identity, racialization, migration, communal and relational and familial connections, and as well as religious diversity. I'll talk a little bit now about just the racialization piece. I don't know if y'all saw recently a status index just released their report. I actually saw this, speaking of Substack, on Kristen Lee Huang's Substack. I hadn't seen the report yet, but one of their findings was that 1 in 4 Asian Americans believes Asian Americans are more loyal to their country of origin than to the United States. 1 in 4. And then what does it mean to be more loyal to a country of origin than the United States? You know, like, what does that even mean? And then for those of us that don't even have necessarily countries of origin, right? Like, I think of peoples who do not have a country. More disturbing, I think, was that, for me at least, was that on some of these statistics, the younger generations were more suspicious than the older generation. So things seem to be getting worse rather than getting better. And to me, it's a reminder that the perpetual foreigner myth perpetuates. Not necessarily surprised, but it is disappointing. Next slide, just highlighting for us some of the myths around racialization, right? Model Minority, that's the cover from 1987, Time Magazine. I think I remember seeing this cover of Whiz Kids. And then on the right is the Wesleyan Asian American Student Association did this campaign a few years ago about where are you really from? And her, if you can't see it, it says, I'm really from Oklahoma. So these contrasts, right, of perpetual foreigner, you don't belong here, yellow peril perhaps also with that. And then sort of this escape hatch is how I describe it. This conditional acceptance. Well, you don't want to be the perpetual foreigner. Okay, let me offer you an escape hatch to be the model minority. Right. So I think they really feed each other in a very nefarious way. Another way I describe it on the next slide is that white supremacy others isolates, names us as foreign. You know, you can prove your usefulness, but you're still foreigners. And then, you know, where maybe we have sometimes bought in is we keep our heads down, right, and build that quote American dream kind of life. Keep our heads down, meaning don't engage things that are unjust. You know, let's just do my job and get the right house, the right schools, the right degrees, live out the American dream, maybe out American the Americans. I'm going to skip the next few slides, actually. I think skip the next three, because it's from the book chapters. And really what it is kind of describes some of the ways I've named our engagement with racialization. It focuses more personally, right? Because we were writing for Asian American young adults and thinking through, like, what does it mean to engage racialization? How do we resist the model minority? How do we defend, like, what does it mean to forgive, to fight against bitterness, against perpetual foreigner? And, you know, since the book's been published and I've gotten to engage more on these topics, the thing that I keep coming back to more strongly and wish I had engaged more in the chapter is how important communal healing and communal engagement is. So, but yes, there's an individual and internal aspect to all these things, but that partly because of the way racialization works, but also because many of us come from communal cultures, really communal healing As Asian Americans in our particular ethnicities or generations or gender, and then communal engagement, living out justice and reconciliation as Asian Americans, that we really need each other, right? The work is too exhausting to do on our own. The work is, I think, impossible to do on our own, both in the sense of the spiritual and emotional energy that it takes, but also because with the Black-white binary and the lack of space for Asian Americans, we need opportunities to connect with others. Not that they would have the same stories as we would, but that there would be opportunities to hear from each other the different voices that can bring healing. So I would say, I was talking with a friend recently about the difference between the Western model of therapy and the idea of healing circles, which are much more communal and things that are more shared. And I'm sure both have their place, but there's something about Western therapy that tends to be more individual, right? And like, oh, you talked to this one therapist and hey, I'm in therapy. So like, I'm not trying to knock therapy. Don't get me wrong. But I also have found profound healing from informal and formal opportunities to share with others just about, you know, things that are happening, things that have happened, think challenges that are coming. What is it, you know, leading as an Asian American woman or family stuff or just all the different pieces, just saying that healing circles or these spaces are really critical for us. Over the last year or so, I've had opportunities to be at different events. And this is what I mean by standing on the shoulders. InterVarsity's Asian American Ministries has a long history of gathering Asian American staff. So for over 40 years, since like 1981, we think. And that has been an incredible gift to Asian American ministers and Asian American students in InterVarsity. You know, listening to David talk just a little bit ago, I was like, oh yeah, it's really fun to hear more of like what you're engaging in your studies, David. And I was just thinking about the ways that different gatherings we both got to be a part of have really fed your learning and your conversations. So folks like our other co-authors, Linson and La, and so many other folks who are leading in different, whether Asian American spaces or not Asian American spaces, the fact that InterVarsity gathered staff at least every 3 years to be in community with one another, to be in relationship with one another, that could extend friendships, you know, even after people have long left staff. That has been the not secret sauce. And I know it sounds simple, but here's the reality is that nobody's making these spaces for us. You know, Asian Americans, you know, many of us come from really communal cultures where we're really good at making space for other people. And you know what happens in those spaces? You make space for other people and then somebody else makes space for you, right? The United States does not work that way, right? And so, and then with the Black-white binary, nobody, we're like afterthoughts, maybe a footnote if they thought to ask the survey question, right? So a conviction of mine this past year has been, wow, how can I continue to bless the church by empowering more people to create spaces for Asian American Christians to be dialoguing? Spaces like this, right? I know y'all care about this because you're here. Whether here or virtually here or watching a recording. So as I think about communal healing and communal engagement, maybe I would say one pitfall would be not to have essentialist type gatherings, right? Not telling people, oh, this is who you are. You must have a problem with your parents or you know, da 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 da, or, you know, whatever it is, right? Like, so there can be themes, right? But prescribing is unhelpful. Our strong conviction when in writing the book was actually to describe, not prescribe. At one point, somebody offered some feedback. Oh, could you tell a little more what to do? And we were like, no, actually, that the medium was the message in that sense, right? We wanted to describe a lot of different stories, different backgrounds, as many as we could fit in a book, and to offer examples, but not to prescribe. There are so many prescriptions for Asian Americans, right? Whether that's from, you know, white supremacy, whether that's from, you know, assumptions or parental figures, et cetera. I don't think we need more prescriptions, but we need more space to hear from each other's voices, to learn from each other's stories. I said, as Asian Americans and in our particular ethnicities and cultures and gender as well, I'll talk about that more in a minute. I'll say also in the past few years, well, actually, I'll say this. For a long time now, in our organization, Asian American ministries, Black campus ministries, our Latino ministry, Native ministries, long been in relationship together. And in different seasons, partnerships have been stronger or, you know, there's been more reason to connect. I'll say over the last 4 or 5 years, our ministry's connection with Black campus ministries has developed even stronger partnership. I mean, partly out of lament, to be honest, right? In these different seasons, partly out of key friendships and intentionality, an opportunity for the two different departments to have some of the leaders participate in a healing circle. There are ways that I think our communal engagement brings out both the strength of our communal mentality and also just the staying power. You know what I mean? Like, you know, sometimes we think it's faster to go by ourselves, right? And it takes a while to organize something with more people. But I think there's a staying power to Asian American communal. Like sometimes it takes a while to get something moving, but once it's moving, nothing's gonna stop that. You know, it's just gonna keep going. So I would say one of the key things I just keep saying over and over now is creating focus spaces. Creating focus spaces that don't prescribe, but offer people chances to share their stories and see where it goes from there. I think part of the thing is you can't control it too much. You can't come into the creative focus space and say, oh, this is what we need afterwards, right? We need a 3-point plan to blah, 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 blah. There are so many aspects and connections and the relationships are so important. I think you really have to enter into creating focus spaces in an open-handed way. Like maybe this focus space will birth something that's an ongoing structure in your church or in your ministry or whatever it is, maybe. Or maybe it's just a shorter term reading group. Or maybe it's a one-off. Who knows? Maybe it's something you just do once a semester or once a year. But creating a space for those intentional conversations, because otherwise there's just not space. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about this because I think one of the pitfalls for Asian American Christian leadership is how do we navigate power? Power, leadership, patriarchy. I've been reflecting on this a little bit. I borrowed this from Nikki Toyama-Sito. I don't know if she borrowed it from somebody else. Oh, the other picture didn't show up. Oh, there it is. Good. On the left I can't remember now what type of tree it is, a towering tree at the Botanical Gardens on Oahu. So the tree is huge. I think we often have this image in the West of leadership being like this tall oak tree. Like the leader is that tree. And that's very impressive. And it stands up really tall by itself, and everybody looks to the tree for what to do. But what is actually more powerful is a bamboo forest. I mean, that's why you can't uproot bamboo, right? Like, it's really hard to get rid of because it's all there. But nothing stands out, right, in a bamboo forest. It's like all, if one particular piece of bamboo grew tons taller than the others, that would be a little weird. But the power is in it being together. I think we get in trouble when we get into the game of trying to become the oak tree, right? That's not to say that we shouldn't publicize our work or, you know, talk about the things that we're working, you know, let people know what we're working on and those sorts of things. I mean, definitely in this process of publishing a book and then trying to promote it has been challenging, shall we say. I was really glad we did it together, wrote a book together, because it's a lot easier to say buy our book than to say buy my book. So I'm not saying we shouldn't try and put our work out there. In fact, the communal mentality is what helped me realize, oh, I got to tell people about our book. It was like, oh, how else are people going to know that there's this resource? So for the good of the group, right, this will happen. I need to make this happen. I just did a training for our org for underrepresented leaders, trying to develop more senior leaders from particular communities. And I was telling them, I was like, you know, I'm tasked to lead the session on networking. And we talked about, at first, I was like, what are the things that you hate when you hear the word networking? And it's like, oh yeah, it's that idea that I have to go out there and show people why I'm valuable and like talk and like play this game and like, you know, do this thing. And I was like, okay, so how about we reframe it? How will the organization or how will the partners you're trying to develop outside, maybe in your city or whatever, how will they know about the strengths and skills and gifts that you have to bring or your team has to bring or your community has to bring? How will they know about that unless somebody tells them? So flipping that idea of, I need to go out there and network and let people know about all the great things, because that's what majority culture does. Flipping it to say, actually, how can I think about the group? How can I think about the whole? And that's actually my motivation for bringing my part, right? Isn't that much more like the kingdom of God, right? Bringing my piece to that. I want to take a side discourse onto gender for a moment. Just as I've been thinking a lot about when David told me what he was going to talk about, the longing for roots, and but also, you know, knowing that there's no going back in that. I've been thinking some about, well, I think about it a lot. I'm as leadership as a Chinese American woman in the organization I'm in and the world I'm in. And I'm going to speak for a few minutes in a binary way about gender. So I just want to acknowledge that. One of the things that we have been praying for in my department for a while now has been healing of brokenness between genders, or maybe a positive way to put it would be greater partnership between men and women. This isn't just a carryover, you know, from the motherland. Let's say, as we all know, the patriarchy and misogyny are alive and well in the West. But at the same time, you know, there are some real challenges, right? My dad's mom, my apo, she never got to go to school, right? So she signed her name with an X, you know, like, I mean, Chinese is really hard to learn, so I'm not, you know, like, it's kind of amazing. But she worked in the fields. I've heard my dad and my uncle talk about how she was really, really smart. She was really, really smart, but she never got any advanced degree. She never got any schooling. I think about her a lot. I think about, this is from the cutting room floor of our gender chapter. Linson, I hope you're okay with me sharing this, but we had to cut this whole section out because it didn't really sit where the chapter was. But Linson wrote this beautiful thing about how when he was an engineer, he avoided the first generation for immigrant Indian engineers. He didn't want to be associated with them, the feeling that perpetual foreigner piece. And he wrote this beautiful piece. And at the end of it, he talked about kind of coming full circle. And when he was a campus minister, when he had a South Asian male supervisor, a second generation South Asian male supervisor. And it was really beautiful. I mean, he's a good writer. And we're working on the chapter together. So I got to read his stuff to figure out what I'm and like, I had to put it down because I realized as I read that I'd never really had a female supervisor ever, much less an Asian American woman. And I just thought, oh my goodness, that's okay. No wonder it has felt so hard. But here's the thing, I think, for me, in that I've had to find mentors. I've had to find friends, communities of friends. And sometimes I think, and I told a younger Asian American male staff this the other day, I was like, hey, you know, I think we women, we find ways to connect with other women because it's so hard as Asian American women sometimes, or we're trying to figure out the system, or we're trying to navigate this, and we need each other's help. We've figured out that we need each other. I was like, y'all need each other too. You just don't know it. I think, and we need each other across gender also. So I want to be clear about that. But I was encouraging this younger Asian American male staff to build those kind of partnerships, build that kind of community. Because if we don't, that's what ends up, those large trees, they fall down, right? We've all seen, right? Like the individualist leaders, they're amazing looking. And then, you know, whatever it is, brings them down. But the other piece I think about these tensions I've been thinking about is I live in the tension of trying to honor my elders and my parents, and at the same time, wanting to honor my kids. Like, who do I want my kids to become? My daughter is freer than I ever was. Y'all, she records her own songs on the iPad, like with these little tracks from this drum machine we have. And then she listens to them herself. Like, she listens to her own voice on the iPad, right? Like, I would never, ever do that. I hate hearing the sound of my own voice. She's freer than I ever have been. And so I live in the tension of trying to explain to her why, you know, my parents or other elders view things a certain way, particularly as it relates to gender, but then also wanting her to be herself and to be free. So I've been thinking a lot about, okay, what does it mean to honor elders and also honor future generations? Who do I want them to become? I don't want it to be that like women take over everything or anything like that. I want partnership. I want real partnership that goes beyond. I want my daughter and my son to both feel really free. Last thing I want to say about power is in that the power is in Jesus' work. I've been thinking a lot about the feeding of the 5,000. It's a passage that has been really important to me over many years. And I think no matter whether you take the more literal reading that, you know, Jesus performs this miracle that has all this food, or you take the reading that everybody shared their food and brought their food, it's a huge miracle either way. The power is in Jesus' work in that, and our bringing our peace, our lunch, even if it looks different than somebody else's lunch, that is what we have to bring, what we have to offer. Wow. Jesus isn't looking for perfection. Jesus isn't looking for the most inspiring, best tasting, whatever, whatever. Jesus wants whatever we brought, you know, whatever we've got. There's something about that power piece, that remembering that it's in the work that Jesus does, that's really important for us. Two last things. Coalition and particularity. This probably doesn't apply to everybody, but I wanted to name it. It's something we deal with a lot in the work I lead. My observation is that in the academy, say for example here, the AAPI coalition is very strong, right? Often. Partly because I think that the ivory tower, right, is such an institution. It's such a challenge. But where things are more open, say for example, you think about grocery stores. Where I lived in the Bay Area, you know, well, actually, where I live now, there's a grocery store that's Korean-based, but with an aisle for many different backgrounds, right? So, like, there's a Chinese aisle, there's a Vietnamese aisle, there's an Indian aisle, there's actually an aisle for Hispanic foods, because where I live, it's just, you know, the coalition is needed. You need that one place. They have all these different things, even though we all know it's, like, mostly Korean grocery store. But in bigger cities, right, like where I used to live in the Bay, you have your Seafood City, you have your Ranch 99, your H Mart, your Mitsua, your Indian market. There's just all these particularities that are available. And I think we have to engage both the coalition and the particularities in the right space, right? So you don't want to make it a monolith, right? But we do have to be a coalition in some spaces. And then in other spaces, it makes the most sense to be as particular as possible. So I tell our campus ministers, yeah, on campus, like, yeah, let's go as particular as you want to go, like as it makes sense, you know? But then when we come together for our gatherings, like, oh, there are places where we need to be coalition together. Lastly, I just wanted to offer Luke 13 has been an important passage for us. We're still actually continuing to pray into it. We talked about it this morning. In it, the woman is healed from being unable to stand upright, and she's restored and healed. And she's been bent over for 18 years, the passage says. And it's a healing that happens on the Sabbath. So, you know, Jesus gets in trouble for that. There's not a rush in that. That I think the critique to Jesus is like, well, she's been 18 years. Like, who, like, she can wait one more day, you know, like that kind of thing. And as we've prayed into it, there's been different aspects brought out to us. One of them is that, you know, I think in broader society, there's not a recognition sometimes that Asian Americans need healing. And even if there is, there's not a rush. It's not a priority. Why would we go out of our way? You know, there's something about this passage as we continue to pray into it that God is offering us. And then lastly, as we've talked about God seeing us, God centering us, that it does look slightly different than maybe the way that I use quotes, worldly measure of centering, right? The language of centering has gotten very popular, right, over the last few years, especially on social media, I would say. And I think sometimes we've had folks get a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that, oh, God centers us. Is that okay? Like, am I really the center? Like, I think we get uncomfortable because it is uncomfortable to be hyper-visible, right? Even to God sometimes. I think what's been helpful for us is continuing to think about what is the that centering, God centering us, God's delight in us, welcoming God's delight in us. Some would say, like, there's a book called Surrender to Love, like welcoming God's love for us, not just the academic idea that God loves us. That looks different than perhaps what social media would say centering means, right? Centering in that context is just different. But God's delight and God's love for us is transformative. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you for listening to the Dialogues podcast. The Center for Asian American Christianity invites you to join our ongoing conversation on Asian American identity, faith, theology, and ministry through the Dialogues magazine, the Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry Public Gatherings, the annual Mental Health Conference, and the annual Asian American Theology Conference. You can find more information and sign up for our newsletter at caac.ptsem.edu.